Hello, everyone. It's May 31st, 2016. We got a good, balanced show this week. We got a cool NASA story. We got a cool SpaceX story, a correction burn about iridium flares, and best of all, we learned some new German words, because why not? Liftoff. And we have cleared the tower. Welcome to episode number 60 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Yeah, we're joined also right now by Connor and Maxwell in our little chat room. Connor's busy watching the Indy 500, apparently, which is neat because I didn't know that was going on because I don't watch race cars.
I didn't know and I didn't care.
It's a family tradition for him, apparently. I've never really been into it. I wish I could be. It sounds kind of interesting, except for the whole going in circles thing.
It's very space-like, yeah? You know, it's like lots of terror, but lots of boredom.
But I was just going to say that this is why I like rockets, because like even when things are going normally, it's still amazing. But with cars, it's only amazing, you know, when something horribly tragic happens. Because if not, you're just going in circles.
Well, that's if you define amazing by flames and explosions, I guess. But
just
going fast on the highway like puts me on edge a little bit. Like if I'm in a situation where I'm having to control my car very tightly, if there's, you know, like a concrete barrier next to my lane, like, you know, right up against my lane, I don't have a shoulder. Like, I'm kind of like, oh, okay, you know, maybe 75 is too fast for me. So I can't imagine going the speeds that they do. You know, I'm sure that it's like really scary, you know, but yeah, it's totally boring.
Well, I'm sure it's really exciting. Like, yeah, like if you're inside the car, then of course, because I have done that too, and it's kind of thrilling and also dangerous. But if you're just watching, I don't quite get it. I do know that there is a bit of strategy involved. I do understand the concept of drafting. I don't know if you know what that is, but I do get that. But I don't know if that's enough of a reason.
Yeah, that's cool.
Watch them do it. There's some interesting physics going on there, but other than that, I don't know. It's just cars.
I had a friend when I was a kid who was so into the Indy 500 that he made models of every single car and decorated them with sponsorship logos and colors and everything. And he would hold fake Indy 500s on a track that he had built. And he would move each car, you know, like a foot ahead by hand and do, you know, however many laps they do.
Wow.
And I mean, the kid was, he was a very, very obsessive kind of person, but very, very smart. And he would tell himself these stories through that and a bunch of others. He was a model maker and a really, really, really good one. Like, kids all over the Air Force Base would pay him to make, you know, lightsabers and swords and guns and stuff. He was really, really good. But yeah, that's the closest I've ever come to. I mean, I watched, he showed me what he would do and kind of demonstrated why he liked this so much. And I never really got it. But that was the closest I came to getting it, I think.
Yeah, I don't think I ever even came that close. But so Connor's pointing out right now that 350,000 people, you know, prove us wrong, which I'm assuming that that's how many people show up, because these are the largest.
But we never said that nobody enjoys it. We just said that we find it boring. You know, that's fine.
I think it's like when you go to the beach, or, you know, it's like they go for the whole, you know, for the whole experience. It's not just to watch the cars. It's because
it's for the meth.
Right.
The peanut vendors and the meth dealers.
Oh, the meth. Did you say meth? I didn't hear that the first time.
Yeah. For the meth. You replied so casually. I figured.
Yeah. I wasn't aware that there was meth at Indy. I am
sure there is. I know really? These people. You get down in the center of the track and all sorts of crazy things happen.
I was just going to say cheap beer and maybe someone smuggles in a joint or two, but that's about it. All right, we'll go with meth. Anyway, should be without further ado, then we'll move on to This Week in Space Flight History.
Yeah, we only have one winner. And yeah, I mean, guess who? No surprise who it is.
Once again, Chubby. And was it this one that he responded? I think he had a little jab at you and he said, try harder next time.
Yeah,
because he got it within minutes.
So here's the thing. Like, I can't make these any. I mean, like, this is about as hard as I can make it. And when I make it hard, he's the only person who gets it. And I think he's going on, like, you know, six or seven shows in a row where he's gotten in. So, yeah, we're gonna come up with a handicap. I think, Chubby, I think you need to be allowed to Google, but you are not allowed to Google any of the words that I say in the clue. I think that's probably a good handicap.
We should have, like, a Hall of Fame or something, and we can induct him and then just, you know, say...
And then ignore him.
You have been retired. Yeah, your spot in history is firmly in place. So what was this one? Because I didn't have a clue myself, but boy, he got it.
So the clue, well, the event was June 6th of 1932. It was the birth of David Scott, a Apollo astronaut, Gemini and Apollo astronaut. And the clue was the beginning of a Falcon passenger. And we were trying to get you guys to hook on to the fact that it was the anniversary of the first launch of Falcon 9 this week. And I was hoping that somebody was gonna mm-hmm. think there was some sort of connection there, but that didn't work. That just confused people, I guess. So, David Scott, I'm gonna start from the beginning, and then I'll explain why the clue makes sense. So, you know, he was born on an Air Force base in Texas, I believe, and then he ended up growing up in a small town outside of LA, pretty close to where I grew up. And he had such good grades from West Point that they basically allowed him to do whatever he wanted to do. And he wanted to fly jets, so he became a test pilot. And test pilots are crazy and close to my heart, given my childhood on an Air Force base that did, you know, most of the flight testing. And anyway, so he ends up getting into the Gemini program, and he flew on Gemini 8, which was the only mission to have been aborted early until Apollo 13 came along. Now, there have only been two American missions that were aborted early. Gemini 8 was really terrifying. One of their roll thrusters stuck in the on position. So luckily, they were able to dock with their Agena target vehicle. Then the thruster stuck. And so the entire, you know, the Agena and the Gemini started rolling, and then they're like, okay, well, let's go ahead and undock. And then they start, you know, it started getting worse. And so it's kind of funny because the Agena target vehicle was helping provide enough inertia to keep that roll under control. And they spun up really fast. They neared, I think, a hertz, you know, one revolution per second, which is enough to incapacitate somebody if you go much faster than that. So
didn't we use this as a past topic, that particular incident?
Yeah, I believe so.
It would have been in March. It would have been a couple months ago, because it says that that particular, I think that happened, what you said, in March 1966. I'm actually looking at Wikipedia right now.
I don't know the dates off the top of my head, but that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Let's see. David Scott also participated in Apollo 9. He was the control module pilot. Apollo 9 was pretty cool. It was low Earth orbit only, but it was, you know, the first chance to prove the lunar module as a space-worthy vehicle. They did some EVAs. You know, it's kind of the only EVAs we ever really did in orbit with Apollo. It's kind of cool that we were able to get some of these awesome photos. They proved the LEM. They proved, you know, did some extra testing on the CSM. Good extra data there. And then finally, David Scott flew on Apollo 15, which of course actually landed on the moon. And David Scott was no longer the command module pilot. He did get to fly down. He was the lunar module commander. Apollo 15 was the first mission with a rover attached, which is such a cool little piece of equipment. I mean, that thing really just folded up and kind of stuck in the side.
Somehow.
Yeah. As a kid, I could never figure out where it was. I thought maybe it was supposed to go underneath the LEM, you know, under the legs, or maybe it was on top. But, you know, I was like, I don't really know. But it got there. And it's only been, you know, since I've been an adult that I've been able to actually figure that out. It's kind of a shame that that wasn't better marketed, I guess, how that worked. But the key here is that Apollo 15, you know, every Apollo mission they named their lunar module and their command mod, or their LEM and their CSM. And Apollo 15 named the command module Endeavour and the lunar module the Falcon. So that's kind of where the clue came in. And going back up to the top of this segment, yeah, Chubby not only knew that it was the birth of David Scott, but he pointed out that it was that he did ride on a vehicle named Falcon. So totally got that clue right.
Okay. So do you have something harder for next week, or
I think I do. Yeah. So this week's clue is a little obscure. If you do some Googling, I'm sure you can figure this one out. But Chubby, you're not allowed to Google any of the words in this clue. We'll see if you get it this time. So the clue is, next week in 1961, where's Hubolt when you need him?
Well, the key word that you can't Google is Hubolt. I guess you could you could Google the rest. It's not going to give you anything.
right.
Or whatever the top result of that is. But it's probably something to do with a cat. But so where's Hubolt when you need him? All right. Yeah. Well, if you think you know the answer to this one, you can tweet us with the hashtag ThisWeekSF. Good luck to everyone. Chubby, I don't know. I guess I don't need to wish you luck.
No, don't wish him luck. All right, so we're ready to start some spaceflight news.
Let's do some news. Okay, so first story up, I guess we had these could have come in either order, but first one we're going to do is Beam. It is now fully pressurized. So this was a story that developed over the course of this past week, and I'm glad that it all got sort of wrapped up. I guess that was on Friday, or no, it was yesterday, wasn't it?
No, it was Saturday, and there was a good chance that it wasn't going to finish yesterday, or Saturday, I guess we should say, because not everybody knows that we record on Sunday.
So Thursday is when the initial expansion was supposed to take place, but there were some issues.
Well, specifically, there was one issue, right?
Well, you're right, one issue, and I guess is that it was not properly unfolding is almost the right word that I want to use.
Yeah,
I guess you could say
expanding. No, that's but exactly the right word to use, I think. So Thursday, I got to get a little personal here, which, you know, means boring, really. I was actually up early enough to watch this happen because I was volunteering at Challenger Center. I forgot that was the same day. So I was up really early. And by the time I left the house, they realized that something was going wrong. You know, they were adding pressure into the beam, and it wasn't expanding as far as they thought it was supposed to, and the pressures were higher than they thought, or higher than they were expecting. They have sort of a safe level that they expect to see, and they were getting pretty close to going over that safe level. So they called it off. They said, okay, well, we've gotten this far. We're going to go ahead and call it a day, and we'll work some issues, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do. And that actually turned out to be the solution, was just lower the pressure a little bit and let the thing sit and kind of unfold.
I wonder if that didn't happen, what they would have done. I'm speculating now. Do you think they would have had to do an EVA? Because I don't know how else you could have potentially.
No, EVAs aren't going to do it because, I mean, the thing has got so much, interstices is the word that I want to use. It's just got all these little nooks and crannies, and you can't access the interior folds from the outside, you know. And during the press conference, somebody asked if they could do an EVA to support beam deployment, and they said no. It wasn't going to happen.
So the folds were on the inside, because I just kind of assumed it. They were both inside and outside, you know, like that's how a fold would work.
Well, remember that the thing looks like a porcupine almost, or like a pine cone. It's got those flaps on the outside, which I believe are mostly the meteorite shielding. And I'm sure that you could start digging around and find some folds, but the thing is packed up so tightly, you know, it's like trying to unfold the wrinkles in a vacuum sealed piece of food. You know, I don't think you can do it.
It's very heavy duty material. I think realistically, it would be, I can't think of a substance that would be quite as difficult. Like, I'm trying to think of an analogy, but imagine just a very, very, very heavy, thick tarp, and you're trying to unfold it. You're not going to do that. You know, you think you can, but then you touch it and it's, you know, exactly. I think it was Doug Littekin who was saying that, right?
Well, he was saying that it was super, super hard once it's inflated and pressurized. But I'm sure that once it's folded up, it's still really, really rigid. Yeah. So, they just kind of held off. I'm betting that if holding off for 2 days didn't do the trick, they would have, you know, kept a little bit of pressure in it and then just let it sit and made this deployment take a week or whatever it took. Because, I mean, what else are you going
to
do?
Yeah, I suppose so. Would there be a way to go in on the inside? I don't think there would be, really.
No, because then you'd have to bring it up to full pressure before you could do that.
Well, I was thinking I can't remember. It's attached to the module, but there's no airlock there, right? So you couldn't lower the pressure inside of an airlock. I suppose you can. I suppose you can seal off the module itself and do that, but that would be.
Well, I think there's a vestibule there, but I mean, you can't fit a person inside a vestibule. Certainly can't fit somebody in a suit. you might be able to do an EVA and detach it from station, but after you have begun deployment, I don't think it's rigid enough to be able to rebirth it. So I think you'd have to be committed to throwing it away at that point. I'm not sure. I don't think that they would have done anything that extreme. I think they would have just waited and waited and waited, because that's all you can do. They were talking about, you know, what their contingencies were going to be. And luckily, once they had finished their deployment attempt, they basically had no impact on the station. They were allowed to do whatever they wanted to do, because while they were doing the deployment, they said, you know, no ARED and a number of other exercise devices. There also were no robotics during this time. But once they, you know, kind of safed everything, There wasn't any impact on the crew. And in fact, they were prepared to have a completely normal weekend and just leave Beam and not even touch it. The big thing that they were worried about was Monday, which is tomorrow for us, but 2 days after the successful deployment, they have a CubeSat deployment scheduled. And you really, really don't want to have Beam doing anything while you're deploying CubeSats, because that's a really good way to jiggle robotics. You know, if you've got this big flappy partially deployed and expanding module, you don't want that. So anyway, Saturday morning they, you know, decided to take their second shot, and it was really nice because it was later in the day and I was able to watch this too. So to do the deployment, they literally are letting in a few seconds of air from the International Space Station. They also have bottles on board, but we'll talk about that later. And so they're, I mean, quite literally turning a knob to open a valve and then counting and then closing the valve. This was as simple as you can get, and really kind of weird in that way, but also really fantastic.
Yeah, I think that they were, well, because the idea was to get it to expand without there being too much pressure, which of course you don't need much when you're in the vacuum of space. Like any amount of air is something. So I think they were trying to maintain it, what, around 0.3 PSI?
Yeah, around there was kind of the, what they were hanging on to.
Yeah, so just a little bit of air. And what this took, how many hours? I think it was projected to be 3.5, but it was longer than that, actually.
Almost 8 hours.
And then from that point, was it, I think it was later on in the day. Well, if it took 8 hours, or was it not later that same day, within just a few more hours, they actually fully pressurized it?
So they were coming up against the end of Jeff Williams' crew day, and they decided, you know what, we're pretty confident that we can get this wrapped up soon enough. So they, you know, they asked them to just kind of hold on. And he did the last couple of puffs that they needed, and then they started pressurization. And then once they started pressurization, he could walk away at that point. But yeah, it was the same day that they finished the deployment. So while they're doing this deployment, were you watching live?
I actually was not. I was up, well, more or less. It started at, what, 9 a.m. Eastern time,
I
think.
Something like that, yeah.
And I got up maybe at like 9:30-ish, but I somehow forgot.
Okay. Well, that's okay.
But I watched and read all about it later.
If you were watching live, then you know what this sounds like. I don't know if they've published... I'm sure that you can find it somewhere, but I haven't run across it. But the noise is very distinctive. So I was talking to Michael Woolley on Twitter, and he mentioned that these sounds coming from this module sounded like popcorn. And I said, yeah, you know, it actually sounds like popcorn inside a four-square ball. And it's weird, but that's totally what this sounds like. There's a little bit of that four-square ball reverberation. And these pops were basically tie-downs, seams that were built to be ripped, coming apart as each of these folds came open. And what's really cool is that during the deployment, I heard this from Capcom. They were saying that they knew where each of those seams was, and they knew when they should be popping open given the deployment distance and the pressure and volume of the air inside. They kind of knew what the arrangement of these folds were. And they would, you know, they kind of were able to predict when these seams started popping. And when these threads ripped open, it really sounded like popcorn with a little bit of an echo. And it was, I don't know, it was sort of satisfying to hear this thing open. You know, it wasn't just kind of slowly deploying over 8 hours. There was this, you know, this visceral kind of feedback that you got.
So they were tearing seams, right? Because I had kind of assumed that they were like some kind of like pinned on buckle or something. It's like,
yeah,
kind of like the sound that you would, and I imagine it would sound kind of similar, like if you had a little clasp that just kind of, you know, popped open.
Yeah. The only thing is that clasps, I think, I'm sure that you can, you know, design better ones, but if you have any sort of a metal clasp, you're again having to deal with a rigid structure next to soft goods, you know, these soft, flexible structures, and that's really, really tough. So I think it's best to just have soft to soft and hard to hard.
So now when you look at the fully expanded module, you can see, I think you can see right on the outside, those are what those little bands are, those little, like you have the padding, the MMOD shielding / thermal blanket, I guess, and then those little straps.
The four straps around the circumference way down at the end. Those are wrapped around the original external shielding. So there was like you know, one piece of cloth that covers the entire thing when it's not deployed, when it's in its packed state. Everything is covered by one kind of flap. And then that flap just kind of loosens and then just gets pushed out to the end as everything underneath it puffs up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are also the longitudinal structures inside, remember, that we talked about, that held the thing longitudinally closed. And then those were kind of wrapped around it and held everything radially in one place. And then inside each of those folds had, you know, threads keeping them in the right place. It's kind of like if you've ever watched somebody pack a parachute, I imagine, you know, it's kind of the same thing. Everything's all kind of tucked in together and lots of things are holding things closed. And
I never actually have seen anyone. I think I've seen it done once on a video, but it looked very confusing.
I think it's pretty cool. I would like to fold parachutes, but I like folding laundry. So
you like folding laundry? I hang everything except for pants. I fold pants, put them up, but I hang shirts because I can't be bothered to fold a shirt. I hate folding shirts.
Yeah, I'm really good at folding shirts. So I guess it just, especially when they're warm, it's nice. Expansion took almost 8 hours. Pressurization was an additional step after they've got the thing in the right shape. They've got tanks of air on board. I didn't know this, but they actually used two different methods of introducing air. And they, you know, pop the tops on these bottles and just pressurize the inside. Our notes say 10 minutes. Did you write that?
I put that in there. I read that, I think, on NASAspaceflight.com. From what the article said that I read, pressurization began, I think, at 4:34 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It was done by 4:44 or something like that. I mean, it was very quick. It was within about 10 minutes and the thing was fully pressurized, which for the force station would be, you know, 14 PSI. So that's a lot of pressurization in a fairly short period of time. But, you know, since it is sealed off, they still have to do a leak check and then they're going to do the actual equalization because I'm sure that there is a slight difference in pressure, even though it's supposed to be the same. I'm sure it's not.
Yes.
It might be slightly higher, slightly lower.
Yeah, I bet you're right.
But yeah, so they pressurize it and now they have to wait for a full, well, what is 80 hours? That's like, how many days is that? That's, I don't know, 3.5 days or something?
Yeah, three and a third days.
Yeah, so they have to wait quite a while to do a very thorough leak check. So they're going to be monitoring it to make sure that I'm guessing that it doesn't lose any of the current pressure that it has because that's how you would know. So once that happens, they can equalize the pressure and then from there, I don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to go inside.
Eventually, sometime next week, they're going to ingress the module and go check things out, but then they're going to just lock it back up and continue to do leak tests.
Yeah. I suppose that is what this is. This is sort of a, I don't know if you'd call it a proof of concept, but what's the word I'm looking for?
It's like a technology demonstration, I'd say.
Yeah. A technology demonstration that you do there on the spot because it is there in space and this is where these things are supposed to operate. So just like let it sit and make sure that it, you know, that things work. But now I was thinking there's already the two other modules that were put up in orbit several years ago and they've been up there. I think they're both still up there actually,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good demonstration that these things work. So I'm wondering now what else they're going to learn from this particular demonstration or, you know, from this particular experiment. Because there's quite a bit of information that I would have thought they would have gained just by monitoring.
Well, I think that's what
Genesis.
What qualified them to get here, right?
I suppose so. I guess so. But now that I'm thinking about Genesis 1 and 2, which was the name of those two modules that are still in orbit.
Mini BA-330s.
Well, okay, yeah. So it's now qualified to, you know, be birthed to the station. So what are they going to do now that they couldn't have done in those other launches?
Well, this is going to be a much longer mission. This is what, 2 years, I believe? And then there's a good possibility that we're going to get to do science inside of it, which, you know, the Genesis modules had, or the Genesis spacecraft, they both had some science done on board, but not a lot. And so there's a possibility of doing actual crew-based science, which is really cool. Again, it's, you know, it's a much longer duration. They're also going to be doing, it's a different environment, right? This is, there's a big difference between putting something in low Earth orbit, you know, in a fairly high orbit and letting it just float around and be happy versus putting something in one of the busiest spots in space. I guess the busiest spot in space where there's crew vehicles coming in and impinging the station with fuel, you know, on occasion, and there's EVAs going on, and it's a busy place. You know, this is a different environment.
We've been focused so much on just getting this part done that I hadn't really given much thought to what they're going to do now, you know, like over the course of the next 2 years. So it'll be interesting to see.
You know, if I was on station and I needed someplace quiet. I think, you know, there's plenty of air in there. All you have to do is set up a fan and make sure that you've got the air recirculated pretty well, and then just go hang out, you know, close the door and just be in a nice quiet little bubble for a while. That's what I would do.
That could be, because there's nothing else really going on in there. I would guess the inner walls are a little bit more absorbent of sound. Perhaps yeah. not. Onboard station, there's, you know, so much equipment everywhere. It's just like being inside of a control room or something. You know, it's just, yeah. it's quite loud from what I understand.
It's like a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, it's like having a vacuum cleaner constantly on. That's probably about right. And I bet it's not much quieter than that either.
No, that's literally the sound level is like having a vacuum cleaner running.
It would be so fascinating just to spend some time on board station just to get an idea of what it's really like, you know, like yeah. big quotes, are, you know, for really, because it always sounds tranquil and wonderful. And I'm sure it is, but it's loud and it's, you know, smells bad. I mean, we have talked about that before. So it's not all roses.
You get used to it pretty quick, though, from what I've heard. Anyway, so that's Beam. I think I'm pretty much done talking about Beam. Does that kind of wrap it up for you?
I'm good. I'm all beamed up, so we can
you're beamed up. I'm so excited that this, you know, went off with only one hitch. You know, this worked pretty well. And now we have, as Jenny on console said over and over and over, we have an inflatable space house. It's so cool. We're taking our next step forward as a species.
Yeah, and it has just this little, because it doesn't look big, and I suppose it's not, but what is it, 550 cubic feet, something like that? It's
yeah, that sounds right.
It's big, and I think it weighs only 3,000 pounds or 3,000 kilograms, one of those two, which is not much considering how much volume it provides. You can quickly see the potential. It's really exciting stuff. All right, so I guess now we will move on to the other story that everyone's talking about, SpaceX. Somehow, amazingly, I don't know why I said somehow, I guess it should be a foregone conclusion, but they nailed another landing and, of course, had a successful launch to orbit of whatever that
Tycon
satellite
8.
Was. The satellites are, you know, secondary to me, because I'm like, it's just another satellite. I want to know about that first stage landing. And yeah, and this was another high velocity reentry, right?
Yes.
Because this was another geostationary transfer.
This actually wasn't a GTO. This was a super GTO. They went above their apoapsis was above geostationary. And that, you know, that's just what the customer needed. It gives them more time to adjust their orbit.
Okay. So this, I guess, not unlike Beam, there was a little bit of a glitch at first, a scrub. They were supposed to launch on Thursday sometime in the afternoon, 5 or 6 p.m. Eastern time. And it got called off more or less at the last minute because SpaceX, in an overabundance of caution, well, let's just go ahead and read the tweet from Elon. I think this is Elon and not SpaceX, just
yes.
so we get the
yeah.
twitch. Okay, you're right. He said there was a tiny glitch in the motion of the upper stage engine actuator, probably not a flight risk, but still worth investigating. I'm not sure what that means, because an actuator can be one of a...
No, this is a very specific thing. This is a TVA, a thrust vector actuator, and it's just one of the little motors. Well, it's actually like a pneumatic tube, I believe. Pneumatic or hydraulic, probably hydraulic, but it's just a little linear actuator that pushes the engine in one direction or another and vectors the thrust. That's all it is.
Okay. That's kind of what I figured, because that is the only thing that I could think of it being, but I figured that there would be a lot of actuators on something as complex
there
as
are
that.
Other actuators, but they're in the fairings and the satellite deployment mechanism. But this was, yeah, this was actually the engine.
So I guess the nature of the glitch was such that it wasn't of much concern, but they just wanted to be cautious. And so they scrubbed it. And so they aimed for Friday, and yeah, and everything went well.
And interestingly, so we know that they test these actuators. They test everything before launch. I think the only thing that they don't do is spin up the grid fins. I mean, anything that can be tested is tested before launch. They don't usually make calls on those, but before the actual launch, they said TVA is go or something like that. Like they tested it and announced it on the radio loop, which was pretty cool. But this was the sixth successful Falcon 9 in a row. This was flight 25. So 25 launches, one failure, doing good, SpaceX. This was also the third successful landing in a row. So how did that work? We had land landing, then two failures, then three successful barge landings, I believe.
So there's four landings total that have been successful. Yeah, the one on land was the first, and then...
Then we had two failures, I'm pretty sure.
I think you're right. Yeah, two failures and then three successful ones in a row.
So this is now the third third successful landing in a row and the second high velocity reentry. It's so insane that that actually works.
You know? I know. Again, I watched and I didn't quite believe it. There seems to always be a puff of smoke that kind of, you know, obscures everything, and then the smoke clears, and then you see what happened. That's just kind of how it seems to work.
Yeah. This time we had good footage from the ASDS, but of course it hung up as the landing actually happened because they use a satellite dish and satellite dishes don't like it when you bounce them around. But there was also amazing footage from the first stage after separation that was shown live. If you didn't watch it live, you've seen the footage on YouTube probably, but we got to see some of that live, which is really, really incredible. It's the first time they've ever done that, and oh man, it's so satisfying as you know, as a spaceflight fan. That footage was actually really amazing for a couple of reasons. We got to see a really close-up view of the RCS thrusters firing. That hasn't happened. Those are, you know, just cold gas thrusters that are used to point the first stage in the right direction. Then we got to see the boost back burn live. And then right after the boost back burn, they cut that footage and stopped showing it. The boost back burn was kind of interesting because I've never seen footage from that vantage point before. I'm sure that it exists somewhere, but I have never seen it and I don't think it's been released. So you get to see the boost back burn from onboard. There's flame everywhere. One of the grid fins, I'm sure that it's got the paint on it. I'm sure it's like ablative or some special paint. And the paint caught fire and there was flame and smoke coming off of one of the grid fins. And then, you know, they stopped getting video footage, presumably. I don't think that they would just cut it, but it's kind of like, oh, okay. So the rocket's on fire. But we knew that these things, you know, basically caught fire everywhere while landing. You know, max damage really does mean maximum damage. And then we saw the landing from the barge. But then they released the entire footage from separation all the way through the flip, all the way through the boost back, or all the way through the reentry burn, and then all the way to landing. And it's beautiful, beautiful footage.
Did it, in this case, flip? Because I don't remember seeing if it did or not.
It has to flip, yeah.
Would it not just, well, flip like 180 degrees, or just because it's not boosting back, it's just taking more or less a parabolic arc, right?
Well, even with or without the boost back burn, the attitude of the rocket's going to be very, very similar. It separates and then it flips 180 degrees and then falls over. At, you know, the angle kind of changes as it's falling back down. That does the reentry burn. I guess the key that you're wondering is whether it did another flip after. Well, if you're doing a boost back burn, then you have a flip and then a flip and then a reentry. And in this case, it's just a flip and then a reentry.
Okay. Because I was thinking it would, you know, it's going more or less horizontal. And then it sort of lets, or it can use its cold gas thrusters to orient itself more or less vertically at some point and then just, you know, fall.
Yeah, they keep a very low angle of attack, so it never goes vertical until it's very close to the ground.
It looks, it's very hard to tell, of course, but watching the footage from the very top of the stage, it looks like it's vertical, but it's, you know, it's hard to tell because they have those wide, big fisheye lenses. And so it looked like it was just plunging down, you know, like just falling downward, but I guess you can't.
And
really
after the reentry burn, its direction of motion is principally going to be down. That reentry burn does cancel a lot of lateral momentum, but not all of it. And then most importantly, they actually add additional lateral momentum during the landing. So I guess it depends on how you define vertical, how close you have to be before you call it vertical.
Yeah, I don't know. What is the definition of vertical?
I would call vertical close enough that if you opened your legs, the landing legs, that you would be able to stand upright. And during the landing burn diversion, pretty sure they were farther than what they would be able to land on. But that's just a guess. I don't know that. So jumping back a little bit to the footage, during the reentry burn, one of the grid fins caught fire, and there was flame and smoke, and part of that smoke, and I'm betting that there was also smoke from the engines, because, you know, you can cut the engines off, but there's still going to be some burning going on. A lot of soot came flying up the length of the rocket, and part of it obscured the camera. And that was kind of when they cut away from that footage. But what's really crazy is that as they came through the hypersonic barrier and got back into, you know, subsonic winds, the camera was actually cleared pretty well. So I'm not sure what exactly was on the camera. I would expect that soot would stick really well, So maybe this was ash from the burning paint or something?
Well, what the three hosts, you know, the what would you call them? The commentators, hosts, the mm-hmm. talking heads. What they were saying was that was actually just condensation from the clouds. And then, of course, it cleared up. Yeah. So that was actually just, you know, cloud mist. And once it pushed through, it just clears up eventually.
So did it just look black because of refraction, or was it dirty condensation and actually was black?
I haven't watched it since, but watching it live, it didn't look black to me at all. It just kind of looked like white condensation to me. It didn't have a dark color. Maybe it did, and I didn't notice, or maybe you're thinking of something else, but it looked
pretty black to me.
Hmm. Well, I just remember them saying now it's passing through a cloud layer and it's going to get a little bit foggy, and then it eventually cleared up.
I mean, it's hard to tell because that box or that camera is inside of a box, so it might well have been actual shadow or who knows what. Anyway, so the first stage came down pretty hard, as you'd expect.
Yeah.
The landing was pretty hard. There was some lateral component that you can see in the video. And they landed down hard enough that they basically used up their shock absorber. Each of the landing legs has got a crumple zone. It's honeycombed aluminum. Elon Musk pretty quickly mentioned that they used up, they call it crush core, that crush core got totally smushed, which is why the first stage kind of wobbled a little bit in the video, because those legs kind of retracted a little bit to absorb the crush or to absorb the impact. And that crush core is contingency. It's not supposed to be used up, but you know, it's a good way to buy yourself a safe landing in a high, you know, what's pretty close to a safe landing, but not quite. It's a good way to do it.
Well, they say that any landing you walk away from is a good one. Now, there were no people on board, but the engines get to walk away from it. You know, they've saved a lot of expensive stuff. Now, exactly where along the leg is that little crumple zone?
So it's in the actuator, that long piston that telescopes. Well, I guess I should be specific, because there are actually two of those per leg. There's a small pusher and then the long one that actually supports the leg. And it's in there somewhere. My guess is that it's at the very bottom. You can see kind of most of that actuator is black. But then at the very bottom, there's a little bit of silvery metal color. I'm guessing that it's in that section. It's obviously not visible, but it's probably down there somewhere, because you want that crush to be as close to the feet as possible, so that you're not so that you can support as little with that crush core. You know, instead of having the entire actuator shift, you just have the end kind of crush a little bit. But yeah, it's in there somewhere. It's probably down at the end.
I had read the tweet where he had said that, and I was wondering exactly where those crush cores are, because I didn't know that they even had them, but that's a really cool feature.
Yeah, this is the first time that we've heard confirmation of them, but they make sense. I mean, anytime you have a landing leg, right, you want to have something like this. And given that that pneumatic strut doesn't retract, you know, once it's open, is locked open, it makes sense that they would have some sort of crushable metal in there somewhere. The Apollo lunar module had very, very similar material in its legs to do the same thing.
That's actually a good point, because if those legs lock out hard, then yeah, you would have to have something that could just supply a little bit of give, because if not, then, I mean, it could be bad. I guess you could bust a bolt, or you could puncture the side of the vessel with, you know, the strut. I'm not sure what would happen.
Or the leg, but I think the first thing that would happen is, yeah, you'd destroy some bolts and that leg would just collapse upwards. I mean, we've seen what happened when that collet doesn't close properly. I don't know if you could bust that collet open, but...
Well, it looks like they have thought of it, though. I mean, they've thought of everything. I'm always amazed about those little things that they, you know, have to take into consideration.
Well, I mean, how many failures have we had so far? We've had quite a bit of time to get this right.
Yeah. Right. It's the unknowns, I guess, that they have a problem with, but that by definition is what's going to happen. So
yeah, really cool.
So yeah, I guess we'll wait for successful landing number 5. When is the next launch? Or that might be covered in launch.
You know, I think it's coming up pretty soon. At one point it was the next one coming up was scheduled for this week, but obviously that got pushed back.
What I want to know now is, when are they going to do the next landing?
That will be CRS-9, I believe. Yeah, no, that was confirmed sometime this week or last week that they were going
to
do that.
I might have to, if I can, just drive on down just to watch that. Now, is this happening during daylight? Is this...
oh, I don't even know.
I want to see it come back, like, you know, see it, as opposed to just the flare from the engine. Not that it makes it a big difference, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just so fun.
Okay, stand by. We're looking at it.
Questions, comments, and correction burns. This week we just have a couple things. First one is just a little, I guess, a German lesson, right? I had mentioned in passing, or no, you had mentioned that Germans have trouble saying the word squirrel, and I have watched the video. It's quite funny.
Now let's be clear: we did not make any value judgments about the languages or the people. We just said it's funny.
It's funny to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's always funny to hear people mispronounce things. But what was the, it's a hard word. I'm sure in German, God knows it's harder. What was it? So Flying Fish just wanted to let us know because I was wondering about what the German word for scientist is. And I was close. The word is Wissenschaftler, not Wissenschaftler, but Wissenschaftler. And for a woman, it's Wissenschaftlerin. So cool. I know a new word. Oh, and he challenged us to say the German word for squirrel, which challenge accepted, I believe, is Eichhörnchen, if I said that right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Ich kann sagen Eichhörnchen. Eichhörnchen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eichhörnchen. Yeah, we can say it. We probably don't say it very well, but it's weird because you've got a ch and then a h. Yeah. Like they're very, very similar, and you don't get a guttural or a glottal stop between the two.
No, yeah. We could do this all day, sorry.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that both words mean squirrel, and both words are, reasonably difficult to say.
Anyway, so back to space. Another comment in our subreddit about iridium flares, and I believe that you had mentioned we were talking about the reflectivity of various objects in space, and you had said that the solar panels are what make iridium flares so reflective and bright, but not the case.
So here's the key. Iridium satellites have really, 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 really big solar panels. They have really, really big, like slightly smaller antenna arrays that are nice and big and flat. And my assumption was that I know that it's one of those two structures that causes a flare or commonly causes a flare. And my incorrect assumption was that the bigger one is going to cause a flare more often. And of course, that doesn't make any sense, right? Because those solar panels are ideally pointed directly at the sun, which means that nobody on Earth is going to get a reflection unless it's sunset and the solar arrays are pointed slightly a bit too low. But it'll still be sunset, which means that the sky will be nice and bright, and it's not good. The key here is that the antenna structure is not pointed at the sun. It's pointed at the ground at like a 30 or 45 degree angle. And so that has a much better chance of reflecting the sun, even though it's a little smaller. So that is indeed what causes iridium flares, is the antenna arrays. And there are three of them. They're kind of arranged, kind of like if you think of a three-pronged fishhook, like three fishhooks back to back and soldered together so that you've got the hooks point in the same direction at 120 degrees. And so they work really well for reflecting light back down to Earth.
Good correction.
Okay, so we have a quick announcement. We're starting a book club with the two great folks over at the Don't Panic Geocast. So go to theorbitalmechanics.com/bookclub for more information. Right now we have a vote going on. You can vote for which of the four books we have up for the first season. You can vote for which one we're going to read. They were supposed to announce this on their show this week, and I think we beat them to it. I think they're going to have to announce it on the next show. But we're going to get as many people together as we can. We will publish a chapter schedule. So you will, if you want to be part of the book club, you'll have to keep up and read whatever chapter we've assigned for that week. It'll be a reasonable reading schedule. And then once a week, we'll get together on a free Discord channel, and we'll discuss the book. There will be voice chat, there will be text chat, and anybody can do however much or however little participation they want to do. If you think that you would like to listen in but don't want to actually attend live, let me know. I'll see if I can record the conversations and just publish them with no editing. So it won't be fantastic, but it'll be better than not being able to attend at all. Also, on the voting page, there is a place to put in your time zone. If we get a bunch of people people from Europe or Asia, we will start a secondary, maybe two secondary get-togethers. I don't know if any of us four or five hosts, or four hosts or two or three research assistants will be able to actually attend the other ones. But I know that time zones are a big deal for people trying to attend live events that are timed for the US. So we'll see if we can take care of you guys. You'll probably be in charge of making sure that people are actually there, you know, but we'll definitely give you some leeway in scheduling if you want to do that. So if you're interested, go to theorbitalmechanics.com/bookclub. There's no hyphen or space, and that will be linked in the show notes. We won't put it on our main page, but if you forget the URL, you can always go to the show notes for this episode and go check it out there. And we'll tweet about it, and we'll put it on the subreddit, and that'll get pretty much everybody a clicky link if they want it.
All right, well, let's move on to upcoming spaceflight events. Just one launch. There's one that's to be determined. Might be soon. It might be within the next week, but we don't know, so we're going to skip that. That's a long march.
Yeah, long marches are not reliable.
Yeah.
Just because of the way that they publish these launch schedules.
The one that we do have is for June 8th, and that is a Proton M with the Breeze M upper stage, and that is launching an Intelsat 31/DLA-2. That's launching at 07:10 UTC from Baikonur Cosmodrome. And apparently we can watch this, huh? Because there's a little link here on launchlibrary.net.
Yeah, maybe that'll work. I'm not sure. It's not something that I really care. I mean, you know, Proton launches are fun, but...
Well, they don't often do live viewings of these, do they? Because something that we have noticed.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So maybe they're kind of getting into it.
This is a link to Intelsat's website, so it looks like they're going to be hosting that.
That's true. Yeah, it's probably Intelsat taking it upon themselves to do that.
Yeah, that's it. There's nothing else happening this week.
We would like to be able to... give some information on when the ingress into Beam is going to happen, but there's, as of right now, there's nothing, but that could change.
Yeah, keep an eye out. If we see it, we'll tweet it, you know.
It will most likely be sometime this week, right? Because it's going to take a couple days to do that leak check, and then shortly after that, they're going to do the ingress. So it should be, what, and then in another 4 or 5 days as of this recording?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm going to say.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on when they can fit into the schedule, because I'm sure it's not an urgent thing to do.
Yeah, there's no rush there.
Ooh, I can't wait to see inside that thing. It's going to be so much fun.
I do want to see the inside, actually, what it really looks like in space, to see somebody floating inside what is, I guess, a giant egg.
Yeah.
But a really cool sci-fi egg.
All right, so that was your upcoming spaceflight event.
With that, we will deal with the show. Now, some people might have noticed that last week I didn't make the Ronald Jenkins announcement, and that's
no,
just
you
because...
you cut it out, didn't you?
I cut it out because of some editing problems I had. I was trying to play a new Ronald Jenkins song, and it didn't work out because it was not available in the right format. But I have another one that I want to play anyway. This is actually from his last album, which came out about a year ago. The next one's coming out soon. But this song, actually, Ben, you may or may not recall, this was going to be, or this was one that you had suggested that should have been the theme song for the show. I don't know if you remember.
Which song is it?
103 Degrees.
Yep. I think so.
So I figured we could play us out with that one. Just because I wanted to mix it up a little bit. We haven't done that for some time. And I just wanted to expose some people to some new Ronald Jenkins music. And as always, check him out at ronaldjenkins.com.
He was kind enough to agree to let us do this. So he's an awesome musician. If you liked this episode, please review us on iTunes and Stitcher.
And if you enjoyed our show, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/orbitalpodcast. Thanks to our $5 and up Patreon supporters in the Ground Control chat room listening to the show live. And we have a new supporter. It was just 5 or 10.
An ADCO level supporter, John Massara. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. You can connect with us on Twitter and Reddit at Orbital Podcast.
You can send questions and comments to info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, please visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com. Be sure to check out our store for mission patches, t-shirts, and hoodies, and visit theorbitalmechanics.com/bookclub to vote on the first season book.
All right, well, that's it, and we will see you in 1 week on Orbit. Until then, later.
Goodbye, everybody.